This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Listen to more of Charlottesville's own public media at civilpodcast.com. On April 4th, 2009, attorney Jeffrey Matsura addressed the society on the subject of his new book, Jefferson versus the Patent Trolls.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Bailey, and thanks. Thank you to all of you for this opportunity to come to talk to you about a topic that I think is timely for all of us and particularly fitting for you all with your connection to Thomas Jefferson. I'm going to take these few minutes to talk a little bit about a connection over many years, a connection that Thomas Jefferson has to our modern day. We know a lot about Thomas Jefferson, but many of you may not fully appreciate the extent to which Jefferson was a uniquely positioned individual and a pioneer in the context of intellectual property law rights. And again, intellectual property law rights, patents, copyrights, trademarks, the law that basically tries to establish rights of ownership and control over creative works. It's a topic that's of great interest to us today because we've come to believe that creative, innovative, inventive works have a huge impact on our economic strength and the quality of our lives. We've come to be so concerned about intellectual property rights in today's world that we sometimes assume that these issues of how does one manage intellectual property effectively are totally modern, that we are the first generation to face these issues. And one of the themes that I'd like to express tonight is that we most certainly are not. Mr. Jefferson lived in an era of amazing technological advance. And the challenges they faced in that era, as we'll see as we discuss them, are not particularly different from the ones we face today. Mr. Jefferson was, as I said, uniquely positioned to understand intellectual property rights because the range of his experience with respect to patents, particularly, was so broad. And by that I mean, as many of you know, Jefferson was an avid and very effective scientist and inventor, a practitioner, if you will, in the generation of intellectual property. President of the American Philosophical Society, the leading scientific organization in the United States of his time, active in the study of botany, paleontology, meteorology. Inventor who worked particularly with respect to devices such as the polygraph, one of the first written document copiers, long before Xerox. Pretty innovative work with respect to agricultural equipment, particularly plows. And also interesting work with respect to the cipher wheel, a cryptographic device. So Jefferson was a man who understood and appreciated and was actively involved in the generation, the creation of intellectual property. But if we look back at his experience, he was also a pioneer in the world of United States patent law. Some of you may know, in effect, right, Thomas Jefferson was the first U.S. national patent examiner. And in that time, patents were basically awarded by a triumvirate, three cabinet members who comprised the Board of Arts. And they were the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the Secretary of War. Interesting notion, if you would imagine what that would look like today with Hillary Clinton, Bob Gates, and Jeffrey Holder managing allocation of patents, assignment of patents. But that was the world in his time. And in fact, Jefferson actually largely drove the process that we have come to know as the method through which patents are awarded. Jefferson, being an inventor and a person who really loved to understand how things work, wasn't satisfied with the notion that you could just kind of fill out a form describing your invention and have it be more like a ministerial process. Jefferson wanted you to provide a working model of this device that you'd invented in order to demonstrate that it was useful in some way, that it was novel, meaning that it was unique and special, and that it was non-obvious, meaning that somebody who understood this technology, plow technology, for example, wouldn't look at your invention and say, oh, yeah, anybody who could understand that in this field. So Jefferson, while he did not draft U.S. patent law, in his role as, in effect, the first part of the team that was the first grantors of patents, in effect, shaped the practice of patent law. And by the way, just to give you a sense of kind of orders of magnitude, do you have any idea how many patents Jefferson's team awarded in the 4 years in which he was on the Board of Arts? Ballpark. Any idea? More than 100? Try 67. 4 years, 67. You know how many patents, about how many patents a major corporation gets awarded a year in the United States now? Thousands. 4,000, I think, is about the IBM and some of the leading companies now will receive 4,000 patents a year. Okay. So I grant you, order of magnitude, things have changed. But the process through which those patents are reviewed and granted owes much to Jefferson, patent pioneer. Okay, so he was a creator of intellectual property and an appreciator of intellectual property. He was also largely responsible for developing and implementing the process through which we granted intellectual property rights. Not many people know, though, that Jefferson was also a patent infringer. Jefferson also got into a couple of snits with inventors, some very, very well-known inventors of his day, over what we would call today infringing on their patent. One of the most colorful controversies was with one of the most noted inventors of the time, a man by the name of Oliver Evans, who some of you may have come across in different contexts, but Oliver Evans was has been compared to Eli Whitney and Thomas Edison, a prolific inventor. His major work was in the field of water power technology, using water to power things like mills. Steam technology, he was working with steam engine technology in the 1700s, late 1700s, early 1800s, and he was a prolific patenter. Okay. Jefferson was using, and it wasn't only Jefferson, virtually every mill operator in the United States at that time was using Evans water power technology to run their mills. Oliver Evans was one of the first inventors in the United States to go out and say, pay me. Lawyers today, we call these letters cease and desist. Stop using my technology until you pay up. It's unclear whether Jefferson ever actually paid up, but he sure wasn't happy about being asked to pay up. If you look at his correspondence, he was scathing in his criticism of Evans. And the main focus of his criticism was, where does this guy get off, essentially, saying that he owns water mill power technology? Jefferson wrote to friends, the Persians were using this technology. The Egyptians were using this technology. I'm not going to pay a guy for technology that has been in use for all of these years on the basis of some patent. Now, what Jefferson didn't tell in his correspondence is his patent board awarded Evans the patent. Okay. And I'm going to come back to that little disconnect. Okay, you granted the guy the patent. Now when he comes to you and says, pay up, you're saying, oh, this wasn't novel stuff. This isn't new stuff. You shouldn't deserve pay. Okay, so Jefferson as creator of intellectual property, Jefferson as developer of the patent, U.S. patent process, and Jefferson as a low-down, stinking patent infringer. Okay. It's rare today to see anyone, and I work with a fair number of technology clients, right, and have over the years. It's very, very rare to find anyone who's really gotten their hands dirty in all of those fields, ever been on one side trying to help develop and actually implement patent policy, someone who was actually an active inventor and scientist, creator of intellectual property, and somebody who was a prolific user of other people's intellectual property and wasn't particularly eager to pay them for it. Okay. So Jefferson had this range of experience and understanding in the key aspects of intellectual property rights, the conflicting rights that we are still trying to balance, and they were trying to balance in his day. Now, what kind of vision does Jefferson's behavior suggest to us with respect to intellectual property, more specifically patents? The Evans situation suggests that while Jefferson is willing to acknowledge that grant of some kind of, in effect, monopoly rights to an inventor through the form of a patent is important in providing incentives for people to invent, the ability to make money off of what they have created, it also suggests that Jefferson has a fundamental concern about misuse over overly proprietary control of intellectual property. And that comes largely from the fact that Jefferson had a very strong belief that the whole idea for creating, inventing, innovating was to try to improve quality of life. And you would do that only to the extent that you could, yes, encourage continued invention, but also ensure as rapid as possible integration of those inventions and innovations into practical products. I'll give you an example of an individual who was also a very active inventor during Jefferson's era, but one who Jefferson, I guess the only way you can characterize it is he basically just took this guy to the cleaners. Jacob Isaacs, 1700s, late 1700s, one of the big issues for maritime fleets, navies, commercial fleets, was providing access to potable drinking water on long voyages. Right? Surrounded by all this salt water, can't drink it. Would be very cool if we could find a way to distill salt water, make it drinking water. Jacob Isaacs says, I got a system that can do that. And he tries to sell it to the U.S. Navy. He tries to sell it to virtually every other navy in the world. He's not having any luck. He's a persistent man, though. So eventually Congress turns to Jefferson and says, is this worth it? Should we buy it? And Jefferson, in his analytical, hands-on way, gets together a team of scientists and brings in Jacobs and asks him to set up and demonstrate his distillation technology. 3 days, Jefferson and this group are grilling Jacobs. You know, what wood are you using? How hot are you burning it to distill the water? Jefferson and the panel, thank you very much, send their report off to Congress. The report to Congress says, Mr. Isaacs' technology is effective. Yay. Good news. Right? Jacob's ready for the money to come rolling in. But in classic Jefferson fashion, there's a but. And the but is that we've also discovered that there are multiple other technologies that work. We are not in a position to say which technology is best. So we recommend to Congress that you don't buy Mr. Jacobs' technology. You don't buy anybody's technology. We'll make all this information to the Navy, and the Navy should check it out. You can imagine that, right? Jacob is not pleased. Right? He says, wait a minute. Okay, you're not going to buy it. You've now disclosed everything. I can't patent it. Right? I'm royally up the creek. Jefferson writes back, no. If you can now take your technology and prove that it works and that it works better. And if it works better, people will buy it. Okay? Jefferson was a true friend, fan of, he was a geek guy. He loved inventors and inventions. He loved to tinker with them. He loved to improve them. He recognized their values. But he did not believe in that any single inventor, or I should say, he believed that very, very few single inventors were ever really creating anything that was so novel that it was truly unique. And so Jefferson's view of intellectual property was we will protect that truly creative stuff that is extraordinary and that is truly novel, unique, special. But I got to tell you, Jefferson would say, that's very little. That in reality, the way that invention works is the way that the acquisition of knowledge works. People tinker, people study, they communicate with others, they collaborate with others, and inventions, advances happen, enhancements occur, and we move forward. So Jefferson, although appreciative of the power of invention, was really actually rather harsh with respect to the significance of any individual single inventor. One of the lessons that I think is an important one for us today, that the process of invention is quite frankly very seldom the image that we see in the storytelling of the Edisons or the Wright brothers or the Oliver Evans, and instead is really more often an incremental process of many people over time adding on and sharing and working with others. So one of Jefferson's key lessons, if you will, for us today is that invention is a process. And it's a collaborative process, and it's a process that goes on regardless of whether you bend over backwards to reward any single inventor. Now, one of the my talk makes reference to a phrase called patent trolls. Right? Is anybody familiar with what a patent troll is? It's been getting a fair amount of press recently, a patent troll. Some of you who are BlackBerry fans may have remembered that the BlackBerry manufacturer, a company called Research in Motion, right, really came very close to basically having to stop selling BlackBerries. And the rationale behind it, the cause behind that, was the fact that a company that claimed to hold patents that formed a critical part of the BlackBerry technology sued for patent infringement and asked that Research in Motion be stopped from selling the technology until this got worked out. Research in Motion and others charged that this was an abuse of patent law, they were a company that actually made something, right? They made something that a lot of people bought and a lot of people used. The patent holder made nothing, right? Manufactured no products. It was, in effect, a holding company that owned a bunch of patents. And the revenue stream from those patents was licenses, royalties paid by people who wanted to make things using technology that was covered by their patents. The notion of a patent troll is somebody who owns an intellectual property right, a patent right, but doesn't necessarily use that technology in any particular product that it makes, but instead relies on requiring other people who may be using that technology to pay them. So just like the troll who's going to require a payment before you are allowed to cross the bridge, right, the patent troll is going to require you to make a payment before you're allowed to use technology that's covered by their patent. Jefferson, no one in the 1800s talked about patent trolls. But if they did, Thomas Jefferson would have detested them, I believe, right? And he would have argued that Oliver Evans was acting like a troll. The key distinction being, and the world that Jefferson saw and believed in, was a world where, yeah, if you make an advance, you apply for a patent, that patent will give you an opportunity, a limited opportunity, to have a competitive advantage in making products, making use of that technology. And based on that, you should be able to have some economic gain. Jefferson did not foresee a world where individuals, organizations, would literally patent technologies with no intention of ever actually using the technology, but relying on others to start using the technology in a productive way and then using legal measures to make them pay. Okay. So the reason why I would argue that Jefferson may well have been willing to grant a patent to Evans through while acting on the Board of Arts reviewing patent applications was that he may well have viewed it as a legitimate effort by Evans to protect a technology that he was going to be using in products that he was going to be making. But for Jefferson, the line would be crossed if Evans used that patented technology not to enable him to make his own products based on the technology, but to stop others from making products using the technology unless they paid the money required by Evans, the patent holder. So one of the other lessons that I think that Jefferson has to offer us is the reminder that patent law, intellectual property law, was not intended necessarily to worry only about the rights of the owners of patents who control technology, but also to worry about the ability of users to make use of that technology in ways that had commercial value and could be used to improve quality of life and opportunity, provide opportunities for productive uses by the public. So Jefferson, from his perspective as a creator of intellectual property, a patent law pioneer, and somebody who'd mixed it up with patent holders and had some disputes with them, I think provides us with lessons that help us to put patent and intellectual property law in a perspective that sometimes, I think, in our modern world, we are losing sight of, which is that intellectual property law was not necessarily created only to reward the owners of the intellectual property, but to make sure also that that intellectual property was used as expeditiously as possible for applications that had value and benefit for the public and the society as a whole. Okay, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time going on this. I'd like to actually, because I think some of you may have some questions and maybe even some experiences with respect to inventions patents, copyrights, trademarks, and this whole challenging area of how do you balance through use of law, primarily intellectual property law, how do you balance the rights of the creators of that material with the rights of users in a way that serves both to make sure that people continue to create, but also make sure that the fruits of their creations get into useful applications as quickly as possible. Questions? Yeah, and I think that's an important point. And I guess I would answer by saying that rather than maybe a third way, it's in my view what we have is there are increments. It's not an either or. It's not either we lock this intellectual property up and nobody gets it until the patent holder is completely satisfied, or at the other end, anybody can use it and there's no ability of the owner to actually exercise effective control. I think we often have, for example, and age drugs, I think, are a good example. It is not one size fits all in terms of the ways in which that proprietary technology gets out to all markets, all parts of the world, at the same time. What I'm saying is there are more favorable terms in some markets under some circumstances with certain limits. There are more proprietary controlled processes, even for the same, in this case, drug or the same technology. So I guess I would suggest that part of where we go off the track is when we think in terms of it's got to be either or. Either we got to do a better job of protecting the proprietary rights of the intellectual property owner, or we got to give more rights to the users. Patent law, copyright law, all of the intellectual property forms of intellectual property law have a balance, and they always have, right? In copyright law, there's the fair use, right? You all know about fair use in an academic institution, right? There. And fair use is—it's not a—you got the right to do this, right? It's that okay, you're infringing, but you're excused because you're using it for classroom purposes, okay? And so we do that all the time. That okay, owner, you have this right, and you—it is an enforceable right, but under these facts, in these circumstances, we're going to limit your ability to enforce it. Open source software is another example. Some people think open source software is software that's free. It's like given away. It's not, right? It is licensed. The only difference is I'm not asking you to pay me money in this license. In this license, I'm saying you have the right to look at the source code, to modify it, right? But once you've done that, If you redistribute that modified, that code that you built off the open source code, you got to make it available on an open source basis. You can't sell it, okay? But what would happen if somebody violated that deal? There'd be a copyright infringement suit, okay? So we do it all the time. We do it all the time where we say you have an enforceable patent right or copyright right, but in these circumstances, we're either going to say, no, you can't actually enforce it fully, or we're going to put some limits on your enforcement. So I think you're getting to a very important point, but I would just kind of twist it a little bit to say that it's not an either-or, that we, part of where we get in trouble is by looking for, are we favoring the patent holder too much now, or are we favoring the user too much, when in fact we should say we trade off all the time. And so what we have to do is kind of look at almost at a case-by-case basis and see under these circumstances for this intellectual property what makes the most sense. That another whole world, and I'm going to only take a part of that, okay, and the part of that I think I'm going to, I'd like to focus on is that type of patent, gene extraction patents, has one of the reasons it causes concern is that it can impede the ability to conduct additional research, right? That if these technologies are patented and then the patents are enforced aggressively, it may mean that somebody who wants to make use of that technology, maybe even for a non-commercial use, but to conduct research, will have to make some kind of payment in order to even use the technology to conduct research. One of the areas where I think technologies like that I would be in favor of trying to make technologies like that more readily available for exactly that kind of use, ongoing research. I would basically look more carefully at the use to which the patented technology is being applied and try to find ways to provide for licensing and more open use of the technology for, while still granting the patent, but for applications like research and other applications that are not directly commercial and are important both to develop additional knowledge and to even make that technology more commercially useful. Yeah. No, they wouldn't necessarily own the products of the research, but they would have a right to claim payment based on your conduct of the research. So in other words, if you use the technology as part of your research, they will not have proprietary rights over the results of your research, but they would argue that they'd have the ability to make you compensate them for using the technology for your research. If that's clear. I think the question of whether that kind of cabinet level position makes sense to me isn't driven so much by intellectual property law concerns, although it would seem to me clearly if you had that kind of cabinet level position, among the activities that department would be involved with would clearly be trying to wrestle with some of these intellectual property issues. But I don't think the fact that we have maybe some challenging intellectual property rights issues to work through in the arts and entertainment, I don't think that justifies necessarily the creation of a cabinet position. But I think that if you did create that cabinet position, I would suggest that among the things that department do would be to play a role in some of these. In that case, it's probably more like copyright type issues than patent issues. But I don't think I wouldn't argue that by creating that department, you're necessarily helping to resolve the digital copyright issues, which are, I agree with you, they're very challenging. Yeah. No, that's a real good question. It's a real good question. It's a real good question, and I didn't want to go on too long, but there was a piece that I didn't tell you, and that piece is that basically, actually, during Jefferson's lifetime, kind of the world changed in terms of how we think about creation of inventions and intellectual property. And by that I mean things like you started to see the creation of what people have characterized as industrial research groups, right? Like companies where their business was to invent, okay? Or companies that would work with universities and then the partnership would be aimed at inventing. Jefferson came out of a time where, you know, that wasn't... The inventor was really more likely an individual who would work on something and then work with other people who were interested. It was not some kind of industrial operation. Once that process of you know, some folks are literally inventing to create inventions and sell the inventions. Once that shift occurred, I think it was inevitable that you would find that people I'm talking about as trolls, right? Trollness is in the eye of the beholder. There are clearly instances where, from a macro level efficiency, it just makes sense that some individuals or some organizations, right, would focus on the inventing, and then that the results of that, the successful results of that work would then get integrated into products by individuals or companies that were better suited to do that. So, no, I don't think all trolls, I don't think every standalone inventor who does not necessarily take the invention to some kind of product and sell the product is necessarily a troll. And I don't think that it would make economic sense or social sense to say that, you know, if you invented it and you can't in some way exploit it, that you have no rights. I'm not prepared to go that far. But I think, once again, there's the gray, right? So is it okay if I, you know, if I develop this technology, I patent it, and I really try to get it to a company that will make use of it, license it, pay me something, yeah, but make use of it quickly. I really try. But I can't get it done. And then, whoa, you know, 18 months later, it appears, and it's one of the companies that, you know, that I tried to sell it to. I think in that kind of situation, right, I don't characterize that individual enforcing their patent rights as a troll. Trollness to me is the obtaining of the patent and really not aggressively trying to do anything with it, either yourself or by trying to persuade somebody else to use it, and then just literally waiting for that technology to appear or something close enough, and then moving in. So I think there are ways to, I guess the answer to your, I would answer your question by saying, no, I do believe there is a valuable function to be performed by individuals and groups who are really focusing on the research and the creation of the new technology, but are not in a position necessarily to take it to commercial market or to take it into use. But where I quibble is how aggressively and actively they really try to, they basically try to promote it. And I think Jefferson would have been more sympathetic there as well. Because, you know, we're all aware of the nightmare story, right? The nightmare story of the garage inventor by the intermittent windshield wipers, right? Saw the movie? The history is loaded with a lot of those situations, too, where there was a good faith effort, basically, by the inventor to try to make use of the technology, to get it out, real belief in it, and a real effort to try to get it out, and either because of an inability to sell it successfully or ill will, malicious conduct on the other party, it didn't work. And in that kind of situation, I think that an individual enforcing their rights is certainly not a troll. Right? I think there's room. Yeah. Okay, this is where historians always slam me, right? Because they say, oh, you're a lawyer. And no historian worth their salt would say, you know, Jefferson would believe this or Jefferson would like that. But I'm going to say that I think Jefferson would very much be supportive of, right? Let's go, you can go down a list. Open source software, right? File sharing, don't you think he'd be into file sharing? I think so, right? And it's because, you're exactly right. It's this notion of, what are you trying to do? You're trying to make information, innovation, and creative work, you're trying to make it more widely available, more quickly, to more people and given them the ability to build on it, to use it, to build on it, to improve it. And I think that Jefferson would be very much supportive of many of those trends. Now, I'll go a little bit off, not so much purely the intellectual property, but I don't think Jefferson would be real excited, though, about, again, not focused purely on the intellectual property, but the fact that, okay, once you open up communication and sharing of information, you get a lot of garbage, right? You get a lot of people who are putting stuff out that's wrong, that's malicious, that's stupid, right? And that goes unchallenged. So, to the extent that openness encourages and enables and sometimes facilitates kind of a real lack of thought or rigor or analytical work, I don't think he'd be so enthused by that. But I firmly believe that trends towards collaboration, openness, sharing, and empowering of individuals, both to access information, to access intellectual property, to modify it, to use it in different ways that suit them better. I think Jefferson would very much be. I think he'd be file sharing, he'd be using the iPod, and I think so. That's, yeah, well, again, my bias, and that's a great topic, okay? My bias is towards more, well, I think you can guess where I'm coming from, more openness, more access, more accessibility. So I personally am very supportive of the efforts to in whatever form, to basically try to make scholarly material available quickly and as broadly as possible. And so anything that essentially does that, I'm all in favor of. And the interesting thing here is that, and I like that, that's a good example because, you know, there's nothing inherent in intellectual property law that says we can't do any of this stuff, right? I think in a lot of instances, folks whose ox may be gored by a change in a publication or distribution model turn to intellectual property and law and say, you know, you can't do that. But that, you know, we know that's not true. So I think that's a very important trend. It's one that I think is entirely consistent with, you know, full intellectual property rights management. You're not losing your ability to manage intellectual property rights by following that approach. And I think it helps to facilitate getting scholarship out more broadly, more quickly, for more uses. And I think that it's, I'd also add that I think it's inevitable.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.